Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor, your host, and we have today a very special guest, longtime friend and broadcaster in Toronto and well-known around the world, Norman Otis Richmond. Get all the names in there. How you doing, Norman?
Oh, good. How are you?
Well, I like the way the world is changing. There's some dramatic things happening. I want to ask today, of course, we want to focus on the subject of your expertise in music and political history of some of the great musicians. And this one would be Harry Belafonte. But before we get into that, I want to ask you if you could just tell us about this Black or African Socialist Party I believe it's Mississippi, but maybe you could fill us in on the details. Their leaders have been charged, and it's the kind of thing that Canada ought to be looking at, because given the hostility now towards Russia and China, I could see that kind of thing happening here. But what has happened there, if you could tell us?
Well, first of all, the group is called the African People's Socialist Party, and three of its leader, Omali Ishatella, Penny Hess, was, okay, first of all, the African People's Socialist Party has European subgroups or groups that follow under their leadership. Now, Omali Ishatella is of African origin. He's indicted, number one. The other person indicted is Penny Hess, who is a Euro-American, and she leads the Solidarity Committee. And the other person that's indicted, his name is Jesse Neville. And they are being accused of being agents of Russia. And they were arrested, and there was a pre-dawn raid on them months ago. And, you know, they came in with military style situation. And for months, they were arrested and taken to jail, released out of jail. And then they were indicted, you know, just very, very recently. And they are being charged with being agents of Russia. And Omali Ishatella has basically Omali Ishatella is 81 years old. He's been in the struggle for about 60 years. And he was basically saying that, you know, it's an insult to basically say that, you know, that the Russians had to teach him about being oppressed. You know, and he's basically saying that he's insulted by implying that it took some Russians to tell him about racism and so on and so forth. He was in the military. I mean, he was in a tank in Germany, I know he was there. He was in the military. He got kicked out of the military because he was organizing, and he became a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And he was with SNCC for a second. And then I guess in 72, they started the African People's Socialist Party. And the African People's Socialist Party has a newspaper called The Burning Spear, which started, it's the oldest running, longest running, I guess, Black Power newspaper that there is. And he has been around the world a couple of times. You know, he's been to Africa many, many, many times. Holland, I mean, he was in Nicaragua. He met Noriega. He had an alliance with them for many years. And he's really an internationalist.
Pardon me, did you say anti-nationalist?
Internationalist.
Internationalist.
He calls himself African internationalists, right?
We're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond. And Norman, you know him. You've done some, you broadcast with him?
I met him in Buffalo, New York in 1981. I've known him since 1981. And I have been working with the newspaper. I wrote for the newspaper, no longer writing for the newspaper, but I have a radio show on every Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern time on blackpower96.org. My show is called Diasporic Music, and that radio station is run by the African People's Socialist Party.
Now, there's been some political support. Some people are rallying to them. They're not isolated, I suppose, as the FBI would like. I've heard that there are a number of organizations speaking out. You know about any of that?
Oh, they've got support from the vast majority of African organizations in North America, Caribbean, Africa. Amy Goodman has done interviews with Omali Ishitella. And I think that, you know, that particular show has gone, you know, all around the world. And, you know, the progressive, an element of the radical white left has came to his support as well.
Yeah. You know, when I just is listening to your description of what happened, it strikes me like your thoughts about this phenomena that when America gets into a hostile attitude towards a foreign power, the first thing they seem to be to do in history, World War One, World War Two, Korean War, is they go after progressives, but they go after Black progressives first. Is that about with you?
I think that the African Native American people, you know, get the first shells are shot at them. You know, the Black folks after the Native Americans have been the most oppressed people, and they've always been the ones that you go after. It was, what was the guy's name? David Walker wrote an appeal in 1829, you know, an appeal to oppress people around the world. And that was in 1829, and 1830, he disappeared. When I say he disappeared, he was killed.
Yeah. And when you think Elijah Muhammad, people don't know that, or it's been suppressed, the history. Elijah Muhammad spoke out against the African-American involvement in World War II, and they put him in prison and arrested him in Detroit, right?
Yes, he was, he refused to fight in the Second World War. He was 42 years old at that particular time. And they basically...
And they drafted him anyway so they could get him. Is that right?
Exactly. He was 42. Yeah, he was 42 years old, and I think at that particular time, he had a Temple Number One was in Detroit. I think Temple Number Two was Chicago. Temple Number Three, Milwaukee, and I guess Washington D.C. They only had four mosques at that particular time, and they accused him of being an agent of Japan because. There's always been a relationship between people of color. You know, the Bandung Conference 1955, you know, where the 27 African and Asian countries came together. But that was like something that had, things like that had taken place way before that. Garvey.
Yes.
And, you know, other people, the Africans and the Asians have had an alliance for forever and a day, as they say.
But they seem, there's this almost, you can almost sense that there's a strategy of using the Black leadership as an example. In other words, punishment by example. That we're going to do this to them. The rest of you will learn the lesson. You think of years later, probably the most famous disciple follower of Elijah Muhammad, Muhammad Ali. They went after him, target him, make sure they, to make an example. He couldn't talk, couldn't speak out. They thought they would crush him. He found out, you know, to the great, very great credit of Elijah Muhammad, Ali proved to be made of the same metal. He didn't bend.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was basically at the peak of his career. Was basically forced out of the game, out of his. He was a boxer, and he came under the. He refused to fight in the war, because it was against his religion, and they used that to say. They wanted him to go and, I guess, you know, sing and dance or do something, you know, like give you a little lesser job. And he refused to do that because he didn't want to be associated with that American imperialism, period.
Yeah.
There was also a guy by the name of Roy Hamilton who sang the song Don't Let Go. He was a great singer. Close friend of, well, Elvis Presley idolized Roy Hamilton. He refused to perform for the, his name is Roy 7X. Anyway, he refused to tour for the State Department. This was in the 1960s. You know, he never got his credit for that either.
Yeah. And very specifically, again, on what this is about, it strikes me it's and there are echoes here in Canada with the CSIS business, but all that happened, apparently there's no disagreement, that they spoke to a Russian, and now that's a crime of some sort. And that the idea is that if you talk to a Russian, you must be his puppet.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that is really deeply insulting. But as you mentioned, 81-year-old man, by this time, he's figured out how to think for himself. We're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond. That's a very important story. I hope we intend to stay with it. I know you do. There is an interesting link here to the topic of the great Harry Belafonte. You mentioned that this leader of the African People's Socialist Party had been in SNCC. I only learned today, looking into the story of Harry Belafonte, that he provided what the New York Times called the seed money for SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was not aware of that, but it tells you something about his outlook on the world.
Before I answer that question, but I wanted to let you know that I can't remember the year it was, but in the 70s, I wrote for a newspaper called Contrast, which was a Black African-Canadian weekly newspaper. And I was working there, and I was sitting at my desk writing, doing some articles, and two people walked in. They were arguing. When they came in, they were arguing about Roberta Flack. One was Walter Rodney, who wrote the book How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And the other one was Horace Campbell, who is a professor, I guess, at Syracuse, but he's renowned worldwide in terms of the whole African history thing. They were arguing about Roberta Flack. Walter Rodney was a huge fan of Roberta Flack, and Horace Campbell wasn't that impressed. And Walter Rodney came in and he gave me a newspaper, which was the newspaper was The Nationalist, and The Nationalist was the official organ of the Tanzanian African National Union, or TANU. I might be getting that mixed up, but it was TANU. their newspaper, and it was an editorial about Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier visiting Tanzania and was pairing with the Tanzanian government to set up a film industry in Africa. And that was in the 70s. And Belafonte was into that African situation way, way, way back then. But the whole question of SNCC, there was a group of people that were burnt out. Fannie Lou Hamer, the great Fannie Lou Hamer, the civil rights worker Fannie Lou Hamer, I guess she's most famous for the saying, sick and tired of being sick and tired. And they let the rebel against the Democratic Party, or the Democratic Party of Mississippi rebel against them. And Fannie Lou Hamer, born in Mississippi, became friends with Malcolm X and friends with Mohamed Babu of Tanzania. They were in SNCC, and they were basically burnt out. And Harry Belafonte made arrangements for them to go to Guinea. And Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael at that particular time, he passed on going there because he wanted to give the other people there a trip. So Fannie Lou Hamer went to Guinea, and what happened was she came. They say she was, in the shower, and Secretary came to see her personally. So they basically said, basically come out, and the president of Guinea want Mr. Secretary, President Ahmed Secretary wants to meet you. And she said she couldn't believe it. So she walked in, she got prepared, and she walked up, and she said, this man, I guess Secretary was 6'4", 6'5", 6'6". I guess he was in, at traditional African gear. And she was basically talking about, how she basically fell in love with him immediately, not in a romantic sense, but, it was like, how was this little Mississippi woman being met by the head of state, one of the most progressive leaders on the African continent? And, he hugged her and so on and so forth. And she basically said that she got addicted on the African question. And, when she went to her grave, she was a big, big supporter of African liberation worldwide.
And behind that was the assistance of Harry Belafonte.
Oh, Harry Belafonte was the one that made the trip possible.
Yeah.
Secretary gave him permission to send certain people over. And Harry could have gone himself, felt that these SNCC workers were being burned out, so he wanted them to go. They didn't have the money, the means, so he basically says, let's let them go. And yeah. Kwame Ture, who eventually Guinea, Kwame Ture, I believe he died in Guinea, but he became Kwame Ture eventually at one point took the name Kwame Ture was after Kwame Nkrumah and Secretary, that's how he got his name, Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael.
Yeah. Well, all of Belafonte's sort of political consciousness, awareness, and role and all that, it's woven into who he is, but the man was an epic talent, right? You're a gentleman who's managed to meet and see a lot of folks. Did you ever see him perform or run into him in anywhere?
I saw him perform many, 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 many times, and I actually met him backstage one time. He was performing at the O'Keeffe Center, and he had a woman by the name, I think her name was Philomi Prince, one of his singers. So my wife, Yvonne Kentish, was with me, and we went backstage to see Miss Prince. So we were backstage, and Harry walks in, and he and my wife begin to talk in patois.
And they spoke patois.
Yeah, they were talking patois, and my wife was basically very good with languages. So they basically started talking patois and joking around, and I'm just sitting there basically laughing. And I spoke to him at that particular time. I was never able to interview him. I begged for an interview, and I tried to get an interview with him. And he gave an interview to a young man by the name of Errol Nazareth. And I was never able to get a hold of Harry Belafonte, never was able to interview him. But I saw him many times at the O'Keefe Center. And I remember one time he was, you know, he was doing his day-o thing. And of course, there were, you know, mostly women there. And, you know, he came out with his shirt halfway open, and and the women are screaming and hollering. And between his screaming and hollering half the time, he was denouncing imperialism and denouncing the mayor of Toronto. And, you know, he was talking all of that stuff, and these women are screaming. And he's up there talking about, he was putting down the mayor of Toronto and putting down Peter Goddard
by name.
You mean Peter Goddard wrote a review of him? Let me get this straight. Peter Goddard had written a review of him and wasn't even there. So Harry Belafonte wrote a piece. You can see it online, criticizing Peter Goddard.
Good.
And yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of important you actually attend what you're criticizing. You kind of get caught out. By the way,
I really don't think I would want to get into any kind of altercation with Harry Belafonte, verbally or physically. He talked all of that nonviolent stuff, but I don't think you would want to get in the ring with Harry.
Oh, no, this is a very tough fellow. He had a joke about his relatives in Jamaica. You know, he spent 4 years, I think, as a child. He went to live with his grandmother and relatives. And they said, "What was that like?" And he said, "Well, they were either unemployed or above the law." But, you know, there's an aspect of him I think it's important that I noticed. I always ask this question about his generation of Black leaders. He went in the Navy. He had dropped out of high school and went in the Navy. And you know what they had him doing was loading munitions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, an important historical detail. It ought to be emphasized. Black soldiers and sailors were given special, dirty, or dangerous jobs. And you may remember there was an explosion of ships in the Bay Area in late in World War II, where Black sailors had the job both of loading the ships, and then when they blew up, there was an explosion killing many, many people. They ordered the Black sailors to go and pick up the ordnances laying around, which of course could at any moment could explode. Some of it's hot. And so those Black sailors said, "No, we're not going to do that." And they were charged with mutiny, which is insane, because they were not attempting to take over a ship. They didn't mutiny. They weren't mutineers. They were saying the job is too dangerous. And several were incarcerated. And to this day, actually, they're still clearing up the records of those sailors. So I was struck by that Belafonte, that's what he did when he was in the Navy. He had to load munitions. And the other thing I noticed is that he got his GI Bill and he put it into acting. And he went into that really advanced acting school where his classmates were Tony Curtis and Marlon Brando. And all those guys are good guys, by the way. But the GI Bill business, a lot of people don't understand, why do poor people go into the service? Well, many are go into the service because that's their only chance. It, you have to risk your life, but you at the if you survive,
you got a pension, and
you get your GI Bill and go to school.
Right.
Which brings me to a question. He was, I understand that the song Deo or Banana Boat or whatever it is, I think it's a banana song or whatever.
Banana Boat song, right.
That was written by two guys. One of them is known as Lord Burgess. And he went to the Juilliard School based on his on the GI Bill. He had been in the Army. So here are guys who are really enterprising in the sense that they risk their lives in order to get a chance in the world, right?
Yeah, but first of all, Harry Belafonte, a lot of people don't know, he was dyslexic. That one, and Lord Burgess was the guy who wrote a lot of those. First of all, his album Calypso, which was the first million, supposedly the first million selling album in history. And Lord Burgess wrote most of those songs. And I was told by Miss Lou, the poet from Jamaica, that Harry Belafonte called Burgess and basically told him to sue me because you can get your money. Because I didn't write any of that stuff. You guys wrote that stuff. And they basically sued. And that's how they, you know, all of the money was released to them. And I read his book carefully. And he was a very, very, he got a lot of breaks. A lot of people liked him. So he got a lot of the jazz musicians like Lester Young and Max Roach and all of these big time artists helped him. And he basically thanked everybody along. There was always somebody there to help him. And he and Sidney were admirers of Paul Robeson. Yes. And Robeson basically told them to do not do what I did because they will basically break you. Because Paul Robeson was a guy that came from at one point earning $100,000 a year, and he was reduced to making $10,000 a year. And they basically says that Sidney Poitier adhered to the request, but Harry did not. He went out and spoke his mind anyway.
Harry, you know, that it's so important to tell that story that Paul Robeson was the inspiration for people like Ozzie Davis, Sidney Poitier. And he was a political advisor.
Sonny Rollins.
Pardon me?
Sonny Rollins, Max Roach. He was the man at that time.
And, you know, it's kind of like a tag team. I mean, he passed on the wisdom and they applied it. Robeson could really boast of the people he taught, both by example and actually providing them with the things they need. Another thing I was struck by, and you may know about this, is that Belafonte, when he was in the Navy, had his black shipmates, some of them, and we don't know who they were, told him to read W.E.B. Du Bois.
Let me be perfectly honest. I've never heard that.
Yeah. Well, that's my late breaking news. It was news to me. And I really liked the story. The fact that, I think the Smithsonian, by the way, I mean, look at where what he's achieved. I was looking for information and the Smithsonian Institute has done a special profile of him with old photographs and everything. But it was there that they mentioned that he was, shipmates told him he should read Du Bois.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another Hollywood aspect of him. Apparently he could have had a bigger career in acting because actually that's what he was, right? I mean, he wasn't he didn't start off as a musician. He started as an actor, but he had his problems with Hollywood. And I read today in the New York Times obituary, they said that he had been very successful with Carmen Jones, which, by the way, I was thrilled at Carmen Jones. It was an all-black cast, as I remember. And it was Otto Preminger and all that. And they were so...
Dorothy Dandridge.
Dorothy Dandridge. They were so pleased with the result that Preminger said, okay, another one. And he told Belafonte, we want to do Porgy and Bess. And Belafonte said, no, I'm not going to do Porgy and Bess, because that is really deep stereotyping. And so he took a pass on that. And as you know, in Hollywood, if you say no to the wrong people, you may not work for a while. And his friend, Sidney Poitier, took the role. And apparently he publicly criticized Poitier for that.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing was, Harry Belafonte was supposed to have played, he turned down to serve with Love. Because he said it was a bunch of white Nazi nuns, and he said it was a black guy who didn't touch him, he didn't kiss him, he didn't make love to him. he was basically saying that's crazy, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, like they was like an automaton or something. He said, but Sidney took it and won the Academy Award.
By the way, now that you say that, I don't remember ever seeing the Porgy Bess with Sidney Poitier in it. I guess they made it, but I've never seen that.
With the Porgy Bess with Sidney, I'm talking about To Serve with Love.
Yeah, but it's interesting that they would have a public spat like that, but they were tight friends and went.
Oh, they were tight friends, but they fought from time to time.
It's very interesting. It didn't seem to damage them in the sense, in the personal sense.
Oh no, I think at one time they were off and on. You know, it's like two brothers. Mm. You know, like your biological brother.
Yeah.
You know, like you one day you fight, and then maybe it might take a couple of years, but you come back, you know, then have another back in, you know, off and on.
Yeah. I want to get your reaction. You're a California gentleman, as am I, in our roots. I was knocked out by when Belafonte sang the songs about, you know, the Calypso songs. I liked Sylvie. I liked... But he did John Henry, and of course this Deo thing, which is with us today. It was just so remarkable to me at the time. What is your reaction? That isn't particularly your taste in music.
What's the song Jamaica Farewell? Basically, I heard about Harry Belafonte because he was a big influence on Sam Cooke. Harry Belafonte was Sam Cooke modeled his whole career after.
Really?
Harry Belafonte. He did the song "On My Way," Jamaica Farewell. You know, Harry recorded that, and then there's a version of Sam Cooke singing it. But his whole career was his idol was Harry Belafonte, because Harry, you know, owned himself. And of course Sam Cooke was notorious for, basically, he owned his masters. You know, Sam Cooke was a millionaire before, you know, one of the first black millionaires, and he owned it. He had his own record company, his own recording studio, and that was basically as a result of following the example of Harry Belafonte.
Mm-hmm. And again, you saw him perform. So what's your reaction to him as a performer?
Oh, I liked him. I liked him, but like I was saying, basically he would spend 75% of his time cursing out the mayor of Toronto and talking about imperialism and unbuckling his shirt and the women screaming, and he will be talking about socialism and blah, blah, blah.
This
he
is from the stage during the performance. The stage,
during the performance, right. All the women would be, they would be going crazy, but he would be giving him a lot of politics.
You know, I think you and I almost crossed paths. You tell the story. You saw him at, I think O'Keefe, you said O'Keefe Center. I went to a garden party where he gave a talk following his performance. And I thought it was at Massey Hall, and it may have been a different time. But he was trying to raise money, help raise money for the civil rights movement. And so his idea was to have him at the garden party, ask people for the, you know, to help out, which he did. But in the middle of his talk, he started talking about the Palestinians. And I don't think anybody at that garden party had ever heard about the Palestinians. I mean, you remember there was a time when it was argued, did they even exist?
Right.
So he started, and he, it was not a light talk. It was a, what you call a heavy talk. He was saying some really rough things. So when he left, there wasn't a big crowd following him. So I followed him out, and he got in his car, and I noticed nobody around. So I just went over, and he rolled the window down, and I said, hey, you are one brave man. So I was very glad that I had the chance to tell him how much I admired him. Now, you were one of the leaders of the Boycott South Africa and the Fight Apartheid. He really registered heavy on that front, too. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, he was We Are the World. He put that together. I guess he had everybody, including Ray Charles, was a part of that. That was one of my few criticisms of him, was allowing Ray Charles to be on that. But Ray Charles was like public enemy number one to us.
And yeah, because he went there, right? He performed Sunday.
Yeah, he went there and he performed on the same day, on the anniversary of Stephen Biko's assassination. He also went to France and spoke. I mean, he went to France and performed, and the Algerian revolutionaries were fighting against French colonialism at the time. And Ahmed Ben Bella and the leadership, I guess it was FLN, the Algerian people leading the revolution in Algeria, sent him a personal message telling him that as long as you are in Paris, we're not going to bomb any post. You know, they would just blow they used to blow up post stations and stuff like that, and say, as long as you're there, you're safe, you know. And that's the kind of the treatment he got from African people. But then he went to South Africa.
Mm-hmm. So, but Belafonte, I mean, he was able, think about that, I mean, to have a really big career, very creative in film, on television, and of course as an entertainer, and meanwhile being a heavyweight fighter in the field of international politics. He went to Cuba. I think he went.
Venezuela.
Yeah. And he, as you say, he had his own way of doing it so that he didn't get hit as hard as Robeson got hit. But he was certainly, he was challenging him on all those fronts. One of his last trips, didn't he go to Cuba with another actor, but I can't remember who it was, but
might have been Danny Glover.
Yes, Danny Glover. And to Venezuela, to Caracas.
Yes.
You know, it's
he had one of the things, I guess, he was kind of different because he was able to really appeal to a lot of the people that were in power. Like one of his best friends was Eleanor Roosevelt. He met with her. He used to like sit down and kick it with her. And, you know, a lot of the, as what Paul Robeson would say, a lot of the big white folks, he had, and he, I guess he probably split the big white folks because he had some of those people that were on his side. So I can imagine, you know, they would come after him, and some of the big white folks would say, no, that's Harry, leave him alone. You know, he was a master strategist, tactician.
Yeah. Now that's an, again, we have to underline, when you see pictures of him sitting with Martin Luther King, and there are some where the two of them are quite alone at a table, that is, they're actually talking strategy. He wasn't just a glad-handing famous person patting someone on the back. He actually was, well, I'll give you an example. I learned that he had taken out a life insurance policy for Martin Luther King in the name of the family without any, you know, did that on his own.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but he also had, he was helping make those decisions, the big ones like the March on Washington, where he participated, but also the strategy on Birmingham and all. Harry Belafonte was right in that.
He was right in that. And one of the King's family disinvited him to the King's funeral.
They did. I'm sorry, say it again.
They disinvited him to King's funeral. One of King's right wing daughters. I mean, he was the man that basically kept her and the rest of the family alive, but he couldn't come to the funeral.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
When people of his stature die, there very often odd things happen that you can't figure out. I'll throw one in here. You know that when Muhammad Ali died, he had asked that a doyen of Turkey and the king of Jordan be invited to his, come to his funeral and to speak. Mm-hmm. That was part of his will. And somebody thought it'd be better to have a comedian imitate his voice.
Well, but Billy Crystal.
And put Bill Clinton up there. But Erdogan came. And the United States government did not treat him as a visiting state. Head of state. They made him come as a Turkish national, only to come to the funeral and leave, and did not speak one word. The president of Turkey, very important gentleman. Pardon me?
The current, he's still the head of state, right?
Erdogan.
Yes.
Yeah, he came, but he was not given a state reception. In other words, they just treated him like, okay, you're a guy with a Turkish passport, and you go to the funeral and you leave. And there was no State Department individual, nobody.
I don't want to spread any myths. Are we talking about the current president? He's still president now?
The current president.
Erdogan. Yeah.
And it just shows that when it comes to a crunch moment, like the passing of an individual of that magnitude, really odd things happen. And you just described one with Belafonte.
And this silly comedian, Billy Crystal, I don't know how he got, officiated the funeral, I believe. Pardon? And he turned it. I think he had something to do with the funeral, and it was, I'm going to go after we get off this interview. Yeah. He basically did a lot of hee-haw and laughing and stuff, I believe.
Yeah, it was very strange, you know, that they ended up featuring Clinton and what you could call the Clintonites. I mean, you know, after all, something in the magnitude of the passing of Muhammad Ali has to be turned into somebody's political advantage, and they've got a lot of muscle.
But I'm trying to figure out where was Minister Farrakhan there? I can't remember.
I don't believe he was. I don't know that he was invited. And I mean, Ali had a will. I mean, and I'm glad we're now talking about this kind of thing. He had said what he wanted, and he wanted these two Muslim leaders of great importance, you know, the heads of state, to be at his funeral, but. I don't. Certainly, the king didn't come to that. He may have had a representative, but Erdogan made it a point of, it must have been personal honor, to which I give him all credit. He came, and there were people in Louisville who bragged about how they pushed him away from the position on the rope. You know, they have the rope around the body, and they were, he had to be like anybody else in a theater who was being shuffled around according to the wishes of people. And he's the president of Turkey. Anyway, I'm glad I got the opportunity to tell a strange story. We're talking about Harry Belafonte. And of course, we're talking to the bluesologist himself, Norman Otis Richmond. We mentioned that Harry was part of the civil rights. He was Hollywood. Now, he also was, he kept experiencing racism throughout his life. There's a story that he had a very successful program that they bought five. They wanted him to do it five times, kill a Harry Belafonte special or something. And there was Petula Clark was part of the show. And somewhere during the show, she touched his arm, and the guy and the sponsors said, "Take that out." And of course, Belafonte and the other guy said, "We're not going to take that out. No." And she, a white woman, this is about 1969, white woman touched his arm. And the sponsor said, "Oh, that's got to come out."
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of that, his special. He did the one. He was supposed to do four more. By the way, you can understand why he says, one of the last quotes they have from him before he died, he was 96 years old. He said, "I'm really glad of what I've done. I wouldn't change anything." He says, "But I have the feeling that for most Black Americans, the same today as it was 50 years ago."
Yep.
You want to talk about that? I've been taking up too much air.
Oh, in terms of killing Black people, that's almost, you can pick up the newspaper tomorrow, maybe right now, they've killed a Black man, maybe even a Black woman, as we speak. It's getting ridiculous in terms of the killing of Black people. I mean, I had a first cousin who was shot 27 times by the Los Angeles Hollywood Police Department. My first cousin named Barry Gibson. So you know, I know about that type of thing personally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that you can't forget because it keeps on happening so often, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that makes you wish for is that they said that Harry Belafonte thought about running for the Senate at one point and decided against it. But there has to, this idea that the Democratic Party or the Republican Party is going to somehow do the right thing and the country will change, that is really dreaming in technicolor, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I don't know about the Democratic. America is such a mess is that, you know, the third party, you need a third party, but in order to really put a party together, you need many resources. And I'm just speaking for myself, I don't really think that the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, like I say, we need a third party, and I have no faith in either one of them. And I think Harry was probably leaned towards a third party, but I guess he was caught up in the Democratic Party, which the vast majority of African people in the United States are into the Democratic Party.
I wonder if he got behind the Progressive Party in 1948 or so, when he was just really getting started. There was a party headed by Henry Wallace.
Paul Robeson was behind, was in the.
Yeah, Robeson and Albert Einstein, I think. Robeson and Einstein both supported it.
Yes.
Shelley Winters, who was a very good friend of Harry Belafonte. I saw a poster today. I was looking at a great poster of Shelley Winters, Harry Belafonte, Mahalia Jackson, and Dorothy Dandridge. And it was for raising money for the civil rights movement. And another, but it was Shelley Winters was one of the campaign supporters in California for the Progressive Campaign. And you're right. Paul Robeson I remember seeing that picture of Robeson with Wallace. That put a scare into people. But they crushed those people.
There was a there was a television show. Oh my God, I'm trying to figure out. It might have been the Tonight Show. I was in my maybe late teens, early 20s. Stokely Carmichael was on there. I remember he was impeccably dressed. He was in sort of like a Nehru type of a suit. Shelley Winter was on there, someone else. And I remember that he and Shelley Winters got into a little tit for tat. I don't know, because she wanted to be an ally, but I don't know if I don't know what the reason was, but I remember Shelley Winters was blonde, and I guess that at one time she was supposed to be like one of the glamour girls at one point, wasn't she?
I'm sorry.
Shelley Winters at one point was like one of the glamour girls, the Hollywood glamour girls.
Oh yeah.
And
she was a friend of Monroe, and Monroe was also a supporter of Henry Wallace, by the way.
Marilyn Monroe.
Marilyn Monroe supported Henry Wallace, as did her husband, Arthur Miller.
But Marilyn Monroe was a brainiac. That was like, yeah, people don't really know that Marilyn Monroe was the anti, the typical dumb blonde. She was the direct opposite. She was a brilliant woman,
and very courageous. Actually, so you remember, she was one of the first people. She wanted to take on the House Un American Activities Committee. One of the few times she was seen in public holding a sign was aimed at them. You know, another theater guy who really deserves credit was in that picture with Harry Belafonte and Shelley Winters was Tony Bennett.
That's my good friend Tony Bennett. Yeah, we gave him an award for refusing to perform in South Africa, but then he let us down and went to Israel. But Tony Bennett, I think that's one of the few things that turned me off about Tony Bennett. Yeah. And when he went to Israel, and who was the Izzy, I forgot the woman's name. She's a young, one of the hottest artists in the world today. They did something in Israel together. But Tony Bennett, I guess his merits outweigh his demerits, I would say.
He hung in there. He's another guy who's a lot tougher than he looks. And people think, oh, he's just, you know, a singer. But no, his machinery's working. he was in and around.
He had a little gangster in him, right?
Pardon me?
So he had a little gangster in him, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a tough character. He got in trouble when 9/11 happened. He said, well, you know, could it be that we did something that would cause somebody to attack us? And they, he said that one evening, and by the next morning, he was saying, I'm sorry. But again, talking about Harry Belafonte, when you see a name like Bennett, or you see a name like Shelley Winters, or any of them, you have to figure he had a hand in bringing these folks in into these things. In other words, they didn't just show up. And if there were somebody who was persuading them, it was very likely it was Harry Belafonte.
Yeah, I think he was the, what do you call it? He was the Pied Piper, right?
Yeah. We got about a minute to go, but we really love it, Otis. You really covered the ground with us. I'm planning to play his singing John Henry.
Which, mm-hmm.
That is a great, for me, that carried me a long way, just to hear him about the hardest working man in American history, John Henry.
Mm-hmm.
You must know that song.
Oh, that's a classic. That's a classic.
And
I had an uncle named John Henry. We used to sing that every time I think about my uncle John Henry Malone. Yeah, he was a couldn't read, couldn't write. He could count though. he was.
You know, when you think, here is a guy who takes over America as a prominent singer, and people want to hear him, and he sings them that song about a black working man who beats a machine in a contest in Virginia, West Virginia, in Newport News. I mean, he is giving everybody an education.
Yep.
One song, a great education.
In West Virginia, was that? That's a hard spot there, isn't it?
That is a rough place.
That's a coal mine town, right?
I guess it is. Yeah. Well, Otis, thank you very much. You're full of information. You give us more ideas than we can handle. So we're going to have to talk again sometime soon. But it's been a great education about the wonderful man, Harry Belafonte. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This is CIOT 89.5, and this is the Tater Report.
John Henry, he could hammer, he could whistle, he could sing. He went to the mountain early in the morning just to hear his hammering, Lord, Lord, hear his hammering. Just to hear his hammering, Lord, Lord, hear his hammering. When John Henry was a little baby, sitting on his daddy's knee, he picked up a hammer, a little piece of steel, said, hammer be the death of me, Lord, Lord, hammer be the death of me. Well, John Henry's family needed money, said he didn't have but a dime. If you wait till the rising sun goes down, I'll get it from the man in the mine, Lord, Lord, get it from the man in the mine. I'll get it from the man in the mine, Lord, Lord, get it from the man in the mine. Well, John Henry went to the captain. What happened? Said the captain, what can you do? I can hoist the jack, I can lay a track, I can pick and shovel too, Lord, Lord, pick and shovel too. I can pick and shovel too, Lord, Lord, pick and shovel too. Well, the captain said to John Henry, I'm gonna bring me a steam drill around. Gonna bring me a steam drill out on the job. I'm gonna whoop that steel on down, Lord, Lord, whoop that steel on down. But John Henry said to the captain, oh, a man ain't nothing but a man. Lord, let your steam drill beat me down. I'll die with the hammer in my hand, Lord, Lord, die with the hammer in my hand. Well, John Henry said to the captain, look yonder what I see. Hold on, choke, drilled on broke. And you can't drive steel like me, Lord, Lord. Can't drive steel like me. Oh, you can't drive steel like me. No, no, can't drive steel like me. Well, John Henry drove into the mountain. His hammer was striking fire. He drove so hard, he broke his poor heart. Well, he laid down his hammer and he died, Lord, Lord. Laid down his hammer and he died. Laid down his hammer and he died, great God. Laid down his hammer and he died. Oh, they took John Henry to the White House and they buried him in the sand. Every locomotive come roaring by says, there lies a steel-driving man, Lord, Lord. There lies a steel-driving man. Says, there lies a steel-driving man. Hoo-wee, there lies a steel-driving man. Says, there lies a steel-driving man, Lord, Lord. There lies a steel-driving man.